Wedding bells are on hold for gay couples in Florida for now. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, where we discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making headlines. A judge in the Keys overturns the state's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, but an appeal by the Florida Attorney General calls for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide the matter. Meantime, a different state judge rules Florida's congressional map was drawn illegally to primarily favor Republicans, but state leaders asked to wait until after this fall's election to redraw those districts. Charlie Crist announces his running mate in the governor's race weeks before the Democratic gubernatorial primary, and the battle of the budget in Miami-Dade continues. All ahead on the Florida Roundup, next here on WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. In 2008, 62% of Florida voters approved defining marriage in this state as between only one man and one woman. This week, one judge in Monroe County ruled that unconstitutional. Monroe County Chief Circuit Judge Luis Garcia ordered the clerk's office in the Keys to issue marriage licenses to gay couples beginning Tuesday next week. But that order, as of now, is on hold thanks to the Florida Attorney General. Pam Bondi immediately appealed that decision late yesterday. Now, as these motions battle in court, the two men behind the challenge in the Keys declared victory. Aaron Huntsman and William Lee Jones is the couple who sued Monroe County after their request for a marriage license in April was denied. This was Huntsman's immediate reaction yesterday after learning they had won.
We're talking about going down on Tuesday to get our marriage license. It's going to be a 3-day waiting time. They're writing the law right now on how that's going to go. So Tuesday is the day. It would love for everybody to come down and join us at the courthouse on Tuesday.
Yeah, Tuesday order remains on hold for now. Tom Luna is a bartender who works with the couple in Key West.
Well, it's Florida, you know. I mean, I'm surprised it came up so quickly. I thought we would be like we'd be like 49th, right before Louisiana or Mississippi.
Instead, Florida is right there with dozens of other states arguing about gay marriage. Opponents of gay marriage remain undeterred, though. Anthony Verduga is the executive director of the Christian Family Coalition.
At this time in history, there is no right to marriage of someone of the same sex. That is just what it is right now. And I think that the decision of the voters must be protected and must be respected.
The judge, however, overturned that decision by Florida voters yesterday. Do you support legalizing gay marriage in Florida? Do you support the current constitutional definition of marriage in the Sunshine State as a union between one man and one woman? Let us know at 800-743-WLRN. Let us know here on the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. And live tweet us using the call sign on Twitter at WLRN. Steve Rothaus is with the Miami Herald with us back here on the Florida Roundup. Ariane Campoflores covers the southeastern United States for the Wall Street Journal from Miami. He is with us. And Gary Fineout from the Associated Press in Tallahassee, all with us here on the Florida Roundup. Steve, let's begin. How significant is this ruling in that it only applies to Monroe County?
Well, I mean, the ruling itself was quite significant because it was the first time that a judge in Florida has ruled that Florida's Defense of Marriage Act, which was passed, the Amendment 2 that passed in 2008, was unconstitutional. So the fact that this is, you know, in Monroe County in the Keys, the ruling only affects the Keys, of course. And the fact is that as a result of the Attorney General yesterday immediately filing an intent to appeal, that triggered an automatic stay. So even the two men in Key West or any other gay couples in Monroe County, they're uncertain whether they can get married on Tuesday.
Nancy Klingener covers the Keys for us here at WLRN with us via Skype from Key West. Nancy, what was the reaction after the judge's ruling? Was elation, certainly for the two gentlemen involved directly in the case and their supporters. What about after the Attorney General filed the appeal and the Tuesday gay marriage license day remains uncertain right now?
I don't think that came as a surprise to anybody here in the Keys. They knew that whichever way this decision went, it was likely to be appealed. And they were really happy. I think they were happy because Key West is kind of stepping forward it's really been an island to itself throughout its history. And for people from Key West to step forward and make a groundbreaking case, I think they felt really proud and happy about that.
Gary Fineout from the Associated Press in Tallahassee. Certainly we heard from the Attorney General's office. What about other reaction from Florida lawmakers that were around in 2008 when this constitutional amendment was approved by Florida voters?
Well, I think it's quite interesting that we haven't heard a lot from a lot of leaders, at least those on the Republican side. I mean, I think we've seen several Democratic politicians, including the former Governor Crist, have weighed in. The response from the other side has been quite muted. Even the governor's statement yesterday about it is sort of straddles the fence a little bit. He mm-hmm. says that he remains in support of traditional marriage as defined by the 2008 amendment. But however, he says he wouldn't want to allow discrimination against everyone. And I have been unable, and other reporters have been unable, to sort of get a straight answer from the Scott administration as to how they feel about Attorney General Bondi appealing the decision.
That's among the questions that journalists have been trying to get straight answers from the governor's office, this just being one of them. Ariane Campo-Flores from the Wall Street Journal. Florida is just one of 31 states that ban same-sex marriage, most by state law and state constitution. Several of them have been ruled unconstitutional. Several of those rulings remain in appeal. So Florida is in a crowded environment as kind of the nation's attitude toward gay marriage continues to evolve and change pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's actually been a remarkable turning of the tide in the past few years. A lot of this has happened in the wake of last year's Supreme Court decision overturning a provision of the Defense of Marriage Act. And in the wake of that, it has been, and this was actually predicted by Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, that this was going to sort of open the floodgates and we were going to see repercussions across the country. Well, lo and behold, we have. This is the group Freedom to Marry says this is the 25th consecutive victory for gay marriage supporters around the country. There have been rulings in federal courts, in state courts. Of those 31 states that still ban same-sex marriage, those laws have been overturned in, I believe, 12 of them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is all being litigated. It may well work its way back up to the U.S. Supreme Court, but it reflects a remarkable change, remarkably quick change. Yeah. In the country.
It'd be interesting to hear from Florida voters who voted in 2008 for or against that constitutional ban of same-sex marriage here on the Florida Roundup. 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Steve Rothaus.
Tom, even today, a federal appeals court in Denver struck down the Oklahoma gay marriage ban, and this is the same court that recently struck down Utah's.
So this would have been a federal court in this case,
exactly,
federal appeals court.
Federal's appeals court, right, the U.S. Court of Appeals, the Tenth Circuit Court. And so basically what happened in the Utah case, Utah is now saying they want to go directly to the Supreme Court on this. And so now this puts Oklahoma in the very same situation.
Yeah, Pam Bondi, in filing the intent to appeal yesterday from the Florida Attorney General's office, intimated as such, Gary, that saying that the finality of this issue essentially will be up to the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems like there may be kind of a subtle nudge there to let's skip forward kind of the due process from county courts to state courts and state appeals courts to state Supreme Court and go right to the federal case.
Well, I think it's important to note that, of course, there's sort of a multi-pronged battle going on right now. We have two cases in state courts in Florida, but we also have a fairly significant case in federal court in North Florida.
Yeah.
And so I think the situation is that they're kind of, you know, they're dealing with separate rulings from separate areas and everything like that. So one can sort of see the logic and, well, try to get it all done in one fashion. But what's interesting is that the kind of the tenor of that appeal notice yesterday, a little bit different from some of the previous filings from the Bondi folks in
How
terms
so?
Of this issue.
How so?
Well, I think as Steve has noted on several of his pieces, everything like that. If you read the initial defense, there was the initial defense in the federal lawsuit was quite firm, and it made a lot of even sort of societal points about why the ban was necessary, and it was. And then when there was a little bit of a backlash, the Bondi's folks kind of changed it to, well, we're defending the right of the voters. And so now to come out and say, well, this is, you know, we really just need the feds to do it. I mean, I'm just saying there's an evolution here in terms of the way that they phrase their legal defense.
Steve, it was interesting because, you know, the arguments that were made in this Monroe County court, among the arguments for the supporters of the Florida Marriage Protection Amendment, essentially the amendment that bans same-sex marriage, talked about that it encourages procreation, a better environment for children, and to preserve the traditional definition of marriage. And the judge yesterday, in his ruling in Monroe County, eviscerated all of those arguments.
Well, absolutely. And you know, the thing is that, you know, the conservative, you know, leaders who were in court were there as friends of the court. They were not allowed to join the case as defendants. So the only defendant in the case is the clerk of the courts, who was the actual person sued for not issuing a marriage license, and the attorney general.
Yeah.
And the attorney general, as Gary said, said nothing in court in either Miami-Dade County or in Monroe County about the societal issues that were first brought up in the federal filing. Because keep in mind that after that federal filing, Pam Bondi herself became the subject of multiple attacks based upon her own marital record.
Right, which is three marriages, I believe.
Well, perhaps three. We're certain of two, but the third marriage, she may actually be cohabitating with this gentleman. And interesting about that is that yesterday when I spoke with John Stemberger from the conservative coalition, mm-hmm. I mean, basically he said that, you know, there were several points. He said that this issue, and I'll tell you exactly what he said. He said, this is an issue worth dying for. Every domestic partnership, every single civil union, every couple that cohabitates, these arrangements dilute and devalue marriage.
Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald. We've got Ariane Campos Flores from the Wall Street Journal, Nancy Klingener with WLRN in Key West, and Gary Fineout with the Associated Press in Tallahassee. My name is Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. And Susan joins the conversation here from Davie. Susan, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I'm totally supportive of gay marriage, and I just hope of same-sex marriage, and I just hope that this, even though it's Florida, that this will go forward and come to the correct conclusion, because I think all of these things, it's just based on some particular group of people's religious beliefs, which should have no bearing on the laws.
Well, Susan, in this case, the bearing on the law was approved by Florida voters in 2008, but certainly we are seeing some judicial efforts to overturn that. Angela joins us from West Palm Beach here on the Florida Roundup. Angela, go ahead.
Hi there. I had a sort of an insight when I was listening to one of your guests tell us what Governor Scott's reaction was to the court case, which is that he said two things, something like, I support traditional marriage, I think everyone should be treated equally. And your visitor, sorry, I don't remember which one that was, said that the governor hadn't been clear, that he'd been waiting for him to, you know, sort of come down with both feet on one side. And my insight was, that's where a lot of people are.
Hmm.
A lot of people are still in their hearts wishing that the norm, the law, were traditional marriage, and yet they do want everyone to be treated equally.
Angela, and from West Palm Beach, we got it there. Thank you for that comment. Gary Fineout, you talked about the governor's reaction. The court rulings that we've seen here are based on precedents in the case of Judge Garcia in Monroe County yesterday overturning, calling the constitutional ban on same-sex marriage in Florida unconstitutional. He cited the Defense of Marriage Act, which portions were overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, and also talked about the 14th Amendment. I mean, it was reasoning based in law, not based on emotion.
Well, yeah, correct. And I think the issue here is that, you know, that's why I'm interested in what's going to happen with the other cases, and particularly the federal case. I think that it was interesting he cited those other rulings and what have you, but I think, you know, if we have a federal judge, especially in this North Florida case, really come out and say, look, federal law trumps everything, the federal ruling trumps everything, there's just nothing you can do, then I think it's going to really turn the tide in terms of how this goes from here.
Steve Rothaus, go ahead.
Well, I just want to also be clear about a couple of things. First, the federal case is separate from these Miami-Dade and Monroe cases. The cases in Monroe and Miami-Dade are right-to-marry cases. So the couples in Key West and in Miami-Dade County and Fort Lauderdale, they are suing for the right to get married. The couples, the eight couples, and then another two and another two, those couples in the federal case, they are married in other places. They are legally married in places like New York, Connecticut, California, Massachusetts, and they are suing the state to recognize their marriages. So that's a separate case completely. But I think it's important to also point out that yesterday when Judge Garcia in Monroe County issued his ruling, he did reply directly to the argument about the popular vote.
Yes, in his conclusion, he had some very strong language.
Right.
You have that there, Steve?
What he wrote was, "The court is aware that the majority of voters oppose same-sex marriage, but it is our country's proud history to protect the rights of the individual, the rights of the unpopular, and the rights of the powerless, even at the cost of offending the majority."
There was a point, in fact, when he talked about tradition alone cannot justify unequal treatment. Nan Klingener in Key West, as the stay continues, the uncertainty about Tuesday builds. Do we know what to expect at the clerk's office in Monroe County come Tuesday morning?
I don't think there will be a big crowd unless Judge Garcia issues some kind of order on this. I think people are just waiting for this to play out down here.
And play out possibly very quickly, certainly. Nan Klingener with WLRN in Key West, Gary Finout with the Associated Press, Ari and Campo Flores, The Wall Street Journal, and Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald, here all together on the Florida Roundup. And still to come, will Florida hold an election with illegally drawn congressional districts? We're back on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. With 5 weeks now before the Democratic primary deciding who will face Governor Scott in the fall election, Charlie Crist announced his running mate this week, Annette Tadeo Goldstein, who leads the Miami-Dade County Democratic Party.
We have decimated the budget. We really have not done what we need to do for our kids. And my daughter goes to public school, and I go to the PTA meetings. I belong to the PTA. I know all the things that we have to do, and we have to spread it all across so that everybody has an opportunity.
Tadeo Goldstein was born in Colombia to an American father and a Colombian mother. She moved to the U.S. when she was 17. She now runs a language services company in addition to her close ties to Florida and National Democrats. Crist's opponent in the August 26th Democratic gubernatorial primary, Nan Rich, said it was arrogant for Crist to select his running mate before the primary. Arian Campo Flores covers the southeastern U.S. for the Wall Street Journal from Miami. Gary Finout covering Florida politics with the Associated Press in Tallahassee. Your questions are welcome for the panel here on the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Our live blog chat happening right now at WLRN.org and on Twitter at WLRN. Early voting, by the way, gentlemen, begins August 11th, so really just a smattering of weeks, less than a month away before early voting in the Democratic primary. Arian, the acknowledgement here has got to be that South Florida is where this race is going to be won or lost.
Yeah, I think it's acknowledgement of how important South Florida is to Democrats, because it's a part of the state that is obviously it's the bastion of liberal Democrats, and it's also a part of the state that traditionally underperforms in non-presidential years and midterm years like this one. If back in 2010 had South Florida Democratic voters turned out at the level that others in the rest of the state had, there is a good chance Alex Sink could have beat Rick Scott. So Democrats know that this part of the state is key. Charlie Crist has been, you can look on his campaign schedule, I mean, he's spent so much time down here. It just shows how important that is. And obviously Crist is not from here. He's from Central Florida. So just as Lopez Cantera on for Rick Scott is from South Florida and is going to hopefully drive that vote out for him, the same on Crist's side.
Carlos Lopez Cantera, who's the current sitting lieutenant governor who was selected just a few months ago by Governor Scott, is a Miami-Dade Republican. So while the Democrats certainly acknowledge the role of South Florida, Gary Finout with the Associated Press, Republicans have to acknowledge that, as well as the Hispanic vote is really where it's at in South Florida that could decide this gubernatorial election in the fall.
Well, I think that is evidently clear, especially by a number of steps that the Republicans have taken this year. I think the fact that we saw Governor Scott come out and finally embrace the in-state tuition issue for undocumented, and the fact that he's gotten his tried to get his message out in Hispanic media a lot earlier than past Republican campaigns. I think we clearly have seen that Hispanic voters are going to play a large role in this election. And I think the other thing, of course, is that the selection for Crist does help him heading into this Democratic primary. It kind of bolsters his Democratic credentials, mm-hmm. that he's not, because, of course, Nan Rich, his opponent, has tried to reinforce that notion that he's an opportunist and that he's a turncoat and that he's not a real Democrat. And so by bringing Annette into the fold and having her stand next to him, that helps him say, no, I am a Democrat. I am one of you now.
Yeah, because Tadeo Goldstein has certainly been closely tied to Florida Democrats, the Democratic National Committee, and, of course, local Democrats as well. Gary, what about the credence to Nan Rich's criticism here, calling this announcement arrogant on the part of Governor Crist, that he makes his running mate selection even prior to the party primary?
Well, that is certainly not sort of what has happened in the past. We could go way back into history. It used to be that when you qualified for the ballot in Florida, you had to designate your LG at the time of qualifying. And basically, back into the 90s, there was a kind of a recognition, especially with some problems that Jeb Bush had with his running mates. There was a decision made to a consensus to change the law and allow a candidate to wait until after the primary. I think the argument was, if you had a primary opponent who did very well, you could ask the primary opponent to be your LG candidate after the primary. So in reality, it's kind of a new phenomenon. We've only had it for the last few cycles in terms of waiting until after the primary in Florida politics. But the point taken that, yes, most of, Rick Scott certainly didn't waited until after the primary to name his LG. But now, I would remind you, Alex Sink actually did it early, too. Now, it didn't necessarily help her a lot,
right.
But she did do it before the primary, although she really had only token opposition that year.
Arian Campoflores with the Wall Street Journal, in the primary here, the Democratic primary, we can't let that go because that is coming up in late August. Nan Rich has been very vocal about her desire to engage with Governor Crist, a.k.a. debate Governor Crist. And Governor Crist has essentially said the time he has got to be spent on focused on beating Governor Scott in the fall.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she's just been having a heck of a time trying to sort of insert herself into this race and engage Crist, and repeatedly calling for him to debate her, and this perceived affront on her part that he would name an LG before actually defeating her in a primary just feeds into that, and it's something that Crist should be wary of to some extent.
Because the concern has got to be on August 27th, August 28th, after the primary. Now you're going after, obviously, a larger pool of undecided voters, independent voters.
Right, right. And Nan Rich has some, solid supporters in South Florida, this very key part of the state, who have been I've interviewed Nan Rich supporters who say they've been very bothered by the way Charlie Crist has handled it.
Lori joins us from Hollywood on this issue about no primary debate so far in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. Lori, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you for having me. As I was holding, I was listening to somebody, I apologize, I didn't catch the name, speaking about how Nan Rich is quote-unquote trying to insert herself into the race. And earlier on, you all were talking about how getting the Democratic support from South Florida being so critical to an off-year primary. And it is outrageous, and I am a Democrat, I am a Rich supporter. I would like to see debates, but does it not bother the presumed the self-declared presumed Democratic candidate that he is alienating the super voters, the people like me who actually come out and get everybody else to come
out. And Lori, this may be the risk, and Gary and Ari, and this may be the risk, a voter like Lori. It's not so much the undecideds who will decide their vote in September and October. It is the super Democrats. It is the Nan Rich folks, it's whether or not they're going to turn out in that November election, whether or not they're going to turn out, especially in South Florida, where Nan Rich is best known, Gary, to help that party and to help, presumably, Governor Crist, if he wins the primary, in the effort to unseat Governor Scott.
Well, I think that first thing I think we should establish something here is that Nan Rich has a very very solid voting record as a Democrat and as a liberal Democrat, and so there's no one who can dispute that. The other elements of it are, though, that she does not have anywhere near the amount of statewide name recognition that Governor Crist has. And nor does she have the financial resources that Governor Crist has.
But I guess the concern, is those super Democrats in South Florida that certainly Governor Crist has got to acknowledge that he will need in November.
He will need them. But I think the issue here is I think what we're seeing on both sides, and this is a subtext of the entire campaign is based upon the, do you really dislike the other guy? If you really dislike the other guy, you will vote for me. Mm-hmm. And Crist is counting on the fact that there is an animus towards Rick Scott that will motivate people to get out and vote. Likewise, Rick Scott and his people are anticipating an animus against Charlie Crist as the person who turned his back on his party as animus for why the Republicans are going to go out in force. And so part of the key of this entire election is, in terms of this, who is in fact going to be able to do the best at motivating their base? And more importantly, if we have millions and millions spent in negative ads, yeah, will we have a lot of people who are just turned off in general?
Yeah, Arian, the most expensive governor's race minus California, we anticipate this fall here in Florida probably, don't we?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's, you know, talk of Governor Scott raising $100 million. Charlie Crist has been doing an admirable job on his side of raising a lot of money. We've, you know, already seen a $15 million ad blitz by Rick Scott. I think going from here to November, there's just going to be saturation of the airwaves.
And Gary, either of the candidates having any trouble at this point raising funds? Governor Crist having any difficulty raising funds as he's not the official candidate, the official sole Democrat candidate, still has a primary to win?
Well, he still has a primary to win, but and I think that probably this speaks to some of the frustration that rich people have, is that there are large elements of the Democratic establishment that have already lined up behind Crist. They are getting in line. I mean, we just got a statement this just a short while ago from Debbie Wasserman Schultz, commending the pick of
Tadeo Goldstein. Yeah.
Tadeo Goldstein. I always get confused as to whether I should say the whole name or because they said that she's not going to have the whole name on the ballot. So I'm just trying to be respectful here. But the point is that the Democratic establishment is there are elements of it that are already lining up behind Crist. So, I mean, it's just kind of, you know, sort of see how this all plays out in terms of once that primary is over. You know, will Rich endorse Crist? I'm not saying that there's not a possibility she could she could upset him. But at this point in time, we anticipate Crist will be the victor. And then can he pull this all together? And can they get enough resources? I think that Crist has done very well at raising money. But again, we don't, especially we don't know what the outside groups are going to do.
The out-of-state outside groups. Michael joins the conversation here from Fort Lauderdale. Michael, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Go ahead. Michael, are you with us?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I had the phone on mute.
Michael, go ahead from Fort Lauderdale.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that, you know, the FDP has been lining up behind Charlie Crist on this for a long, long time. And I think that if they had just stayed out of it and allowed Crist and Rich to really go at it in this primary, it would be a lot more energizing for the Democratic base to turn out. But as it is right now, there's so much disenfranchisement for the rank-and-file Democrats that I don't think that Crist is really going to have the power to beat Rick Scott at the end of the day, even if he does become the Democratic nominee.
Michael from Fort Lauderdale there, concerned, Gary, about the ability to energize the base in the Democratic Party. And that's, of course, been the concern with Governor Crist since he changed party affiliation not too many years ago.
Well, no doubt. And that's why I think there was a lot of push by some people to try to get Bill Nelson in the race.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Alex Sink at one point in time labeled Crist would be a disaster. I mean, I think and there is a lot of evidence to suggest that the Scott people really wanted Crist as the nominee from the get-go because they feel that they can do a job contrasting their records, contrasting the economic history, the job situation. And, you know, but then on the other side, we have the Democrats. They're trying to turn the conversation to stuff like, well, why doesn't Governor Scott come out one way or the other firmly on minimum wage?
Right.
Or what is he going to say about gay marriage?
Or climate change.
Or climate change or things of that nature. So right. That's sort of where the balancing act is going to be.
Well, we've got 3.5 months now until Election Day 2014, and some Florida voters could wind up voting in illegally drawn congressional districts. A ruling last week declared 2 of Florida's 27 congressional districts invalid because their boundaries were drawn to favor Republicans. Florida's Constitution prohibits politics from being used to draw congressional districts, and with 2 districts now affected, any redrawing effort is going to have to spill over to those bordering areas. So we've got the November general election approaching. Absentee ballots, Gary and Arian, already have been mailed to overseas voters. Ron Lebowski is the general counsel for the Florida State Association of Supervisors of Elections Officials.
There just doesn't seem to be a window of time sufficient between now and November to recraft these districts, have new qualifying in the revised districts, have a primary and then a subsequent general election on November 4th.
And that's the timing here involved, with Florida legislative leaders agreeing to redraw the districts. They say it'll be done, but only after this election cycle. The judge who overturned the map earlier this month will hold a hearing on Thursday next week, hearing from voter groups who want to draw a new map before the November election. Arian Campoflores with the Wall Street Journal covering this from Miami. Gary Fineout from Tallahassee with the Associated Press. Gary, you've been in the courtroom during these arguments. You've seen these motions move back and forth. The 2 illegally drawn districts are the 5th and the 10th in Northeast and Central Florida. How does it affect the political balance in Washington for Florida if the districts are redrawn ahead of the November election?
Well, I think if they are in fact redrawn, I think that obviously it would give the Democrats an opportunity to maybe pick up one seat. Or 2. I think the situation here, of course, is that could you get somebody who's not running now to jump into a race,
right,
and to suddenly say, "I'm going to run against an established incumbent"? I think it more likely that this could have more of a play in 2016, when we would definitely have more time, more lead up. Certainly, the groups who are pushing this are the David King, the attorney for the groups have sued. Point blank said he thinks that they can still do it.
Yeah,
they can accomplish this, and they could get the districts done.
He's the lawyer for the League of Women Voters, and has said that Florida's already held one election using an unconstitutional map in 2012. Judge, you certainly don't want to do that again here in 2014.
Right. I mean, they're pushing really hard for this, to try to do this before. Logistically, it's kind of hard to see how they do it, and that's certainly been the argument by the lawmakers in Tallahassee and the supervisors of elections, saying, look, we've already sent absentee ballots out to folks overseas. We're about to send out another huge batch,
yep,
next week. So it's just simply not feasible to do it. And it is, frankly, kind of hard to see how they do it.
But Gary, we had seen some discussion this week that the judge was to some degree surprised that state legislative leaders agreed with the ruling. He was anticipating a stronger appeals process that would have delayed any kind of concept of having to redraw before the November election.
Well, that was a bit of a remarkable moment to have the judge say from the stand, I really had no thought that this would not be appealed.
Tells us a little bit about something about American justice, too.
But I think the important thing we have to kind of look at the whole picture here. Basically, Judge Lewis found only 2 districts unconstitutional. He didn't find districts in South Florida, such as the district held by Representative Garcia.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say that one was unconstitutional. There was ones in Tampa Bay and a couple of other ones. So the groups who sued, they had said that there were several districts that were unconstitutional. He only found 2. So I think that they're, from the point of view of the legislature, I think they may have viewed this as, this is the best decision we are going to get at this point in time. So why not just say, fine, judge, you're right. We will redraw these the 2 districts that you claim are that you contend are unconstitutional, and then go forward. And so I think for the groups that sued, I think they're wondering, well, maybe if we take it all the way up to the state Supreme Court, we might get a more favorable ruling. And so the plaintiffs in this group have not ruled out themselves that they could appeal Judge Lewis.
I think, you know, and buried in all this drama about is an illegal district going to vote in the November election, which is certainly noteworthy, Arian, is the debate about the process that led to this now illegal map, essentially. I mean, the judge had said, listen, you guys in the legislature are not supposed to use politics to draw lines on a map when it comes to congressional districts. You did it in this case. Let's talk about reforming that process or whether or not that process needs reforming.
Right, which was the whole point of these amendments that were passed by Florida voters, which was to try to remove that, you know, the partisanship from the process of drawing the maps. And he was, the judge was scathing in his assessment of it. I mean, he said they made a mockery of the process. And in a lot of ways, it mimics a debate that we've seen throughout the country over gerrymandering and over the redistricting processes. And a lot of ways, the nation's now looking at what's going on in Florida, but it sort of bolsters the argument of those who say, look, we need to just take this completely out of the hands of lawmakers, you know, do something like what they have in California, where they've put that process in the hands of citizens and taking it out of the hands of lawmakers. So, you know, it's a debate that has ramifications potentially nationally.
And Gary, it can't be too early to have this close debate about the process that led to the maps. The process wasn't invalidated per se, but certainly the result was invalidated by the judge's decision.
Well, you know, and as a sidelight, there's still a lot about that process that we don't entirely know.
Right.
I mean, we didn't even get into the fact, but we have the judge who basically said, well, I saw this evidence that no one in the public has seen of emails and documents involving GOP consultants that helped me form my decision. And right now there's another separate case that's up before the state Supreme Court about that evidence. But in terms of, you know, changing the process, I think we're not 100% certain about exactly what happened. I mean, we have the phantom map that was submitted by a member of the public, and then the young man wound up saying, well, someone created an email account in my name and submitted it. I mean, so we have all these kind of mysteries hanging out there about the process.
Don't look behind the curtain here, Gary. Do not look behind the curtain. Gary Fineout, covering Florida politics for the Associated Press in Tallahassee, with us here on the Florida Roundup. Arian Campoflores from the Wall Street Journal here in Miami. I'm Tom Hudson. Still to come on our program, the budget battle in Miami-Dade County, the chief negotiator for the police, and the top supporter for the libraries. What do they want? What could they get? That's next. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The Miami-Dade County Commission this week took important steps toward its $6 billion plus budget that begins in October. The commission voted to slightly raise the property tax rate used to pay for libraries, but other rates used to fund the police department and other agencies will remain flat. The votes now mean that almost 600 jobs, including more than 200 police department jobs, could be cut. Shorter hours at a few libraries could continue, and library staffing will remain smaller than it was 3 years ago if the proposed budget from County Mayor Carlos Jimenez goes forward. Arian Campoflores covers the Southeast for the Wall Street Journal along with us. John Rivera is the president of the Dade County Police Benevolent Association, joining us here on the telephone. And John Quick is with Friends of Miami-Dade Public Libraries. John Rivera and John Quick are two of those folks that are representing certainly interests in this county budget. John Rivera, do you see libraries as a competition for public dollars?
No, actually, I think we're both trying to do the right thing for the community. Where the mayor should be doing it, we're doing it for him. So I don't see them as competitions. I think we're partners in trying to make a better community.
John Quick, would you describe police as partners in this budget process?
Absolutely. I agree that there should be no competition for dollars between the police and libraries. Well, they both have public safety aspects. We help keep the kids off the street, and you know, everybody knows what the police do, and we thank them for what they do.
Arguably, though, John Quick, your team was successful this week in getting a higher than proposed budget out of the county commissioners, potentially, whereas John Rivera, the police, and other agencies were not. What's the message?
First I want to thank the eight commissioners who did vote for the increase in the budget from what was being proposed by the mayor. We were a little disappointed. We didn't get the full amount that the experts had said was was necessary.
You potentially could get $53 million under what was raised earlier this week. You were asking for $64 million. The mayor's budget was in the mid-$40 million range.
Correct. Actually, originally the mayor was proposing a $30 million budget through I think, in part at least by our efforts, it got it up to 45 at the time of proposal to the county commission.
And now up as high as 53. Will that do it?
That will maintain the status quo as to what things are. It won't provide enhanced services. People in South Dade, there was a proposal for them to get the wildly successful and popular U Media. That won't take place. The enhancements and upgrades to the children's areas and the collections, which includes computers, that's just not in the budget, unfortunately.
You going to settle for $53 million? Is it over? Is the negotiation finalized?
I think, in terms, this is a millage cap that
that's
has
right.
been set. So
it could be
terms,
as high. The official rate hasn't been set yet.
Yeah, in terms of this year, that is the cap as to where we are at. This is a long-term process. I think somebody had said, Margaret Thatcher said one point, sometimes you have to fight a battle more than once to win it. So.
John Rivera, meantime, for the police, using John Quick's analysis here, that the millage rate is set, your millage rate that'll fund the police department is set, an 8% cut in payroll. The mayor continues to say it's a worst-case scenario based upon the snapback provisions and the concessions that your membership agreed to a few years ago that are set to snap back come October 1st.
Well, yeah, and people need to understand that a budget is a political philosophy, of political stance by a particular person. So it was very obvious that Mayor Jimenez did not put public safety as a priority. He left it for last. Since he's been in office, we've seen that over and over again, not just with us, but the fire boats, and there's many examples. But, it's some interesting months are ahead of us, and we'll see what's going on, because I have a funny feeling that the mayor is trying to play a game, trying to outsmart the commissioners, and it might backfire on him a little bit. So I think there's some interesting stuff that we need to watch.
What's the game here at play, do you think, John Rivera? How's the mayor trying to outsmart the commissioners?
Well, remember, the mayor was highly upset when the commissioners did not back him on the 5%, which was a promise, one of many promises that the mayor had made to labor.
This was an additional 5% the mayor wanted labor to contribute to health care.
That's correct, and they didn't side with him, and he was highly upset about that. And so I think he's kind of like trying to say, okay, well, I'm not going to raise taxes now. I'm going to put the monkey on your back, commissioners. And I think he thinks that he can outsmart the 13 of them. And I don't know. I think some interesting times are ahead of us. I got a funny feeling.
Well, I think we're living in those interesting times right now, John Rivera. Certainly the budget from Mayor Jimenez calls for an 8% cut in payroll. He calls it worst case scenario. But he contends that even with the police department staff reductions, the number of cops on the street will remain the same. You agree?
No, that's misinformation that he's putting out. I mean, look, if you cut 228 officers, I don't care where you pull them. He calls it administrative, behind the desk.
Investigatives, not street cops.
Yeah, I know, but there's no such thing as administrative stuff behind the desk. What we have is investigators who on occasion have to go to their computers and sit behind a desk to do part of their investigation, and then they're back on the streets. At the end of the day, if you take cops away, we're going to have less cops. Something's going to suffer, and we're already suffering. We're already taking 2 or 3 hours to respond to a call. I mean, we're becoming a county where if you call 911 at the same time that you call a pizzeria, there's a good likelihood the pizza's going to arrive before the cops.
John, you've used that line to certainly some effect here. You've also talked about citizens ought to buy an attack dog or buy a gun if the mayor's budget goes through come October 1st. And the mayor has called those comments irresponsible, that they feed to the perception of public insecurity. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I got to tell you, I've been confronted by many people, and they're the ones that gave me the idea. He is trying to intimidate the community, trying to intimidate employees, trying to intimidate the commissioners. This is sort of a Tea Partyist mentality. He does not put public safety as a priority. That's case in point. There's no argument about that, and he doesn't really care whether people suffer because he's not going to suffer at the end of the day.
Well, he would argue that you're still going to have the same number of patrol officers, that he's trying to get budget outcomes, budget spending in line with revenues, and trying to, you know, put to some degree this back to the unions to agree to continue those concessions that were agreed to back in 2011.
Well, if you look back in history and you see that the day that they, our officers, our investigators in public corruption, made a connection between fraudulent absentee ballots and his campaign office, from that day forward, he did away with the public corruption unit, and little by little, he's been punishing the police department because he didn't feel that his own police department should have been investigating him. And so if you look at the history, it's been nothing but a deterioration under his leadership, and he can't put that on the unions. He's got to eat that one.
John Rivera with the Dade County Police Benevolent Association. Are you in active negotiations right now with the mayor?
Actually, not. He brought in a lawyer that there was a conflict of interest. So technically, we haven't even officially sat the first time. And the ball's in their court, and we're just hanging around waiting. You know, he's been telling the commissioners and the community there's a desperation to sit down at a table. We haven't even gotten a phone call from him.
And the ball's in their court because you contend that the negotiator is inappropriate. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And their contention is there is no conflict of interest with the negotiator, even though this negotiator in question has experience with your organization. He was on the other side of the table several cycles ago.
I don't think that they've refuted that yet. I think on scene, the lawyer himself said, come on, John, I mean, this, but I don't think we've got an official response from the county at all.
Meantime, the concessions that your folks agreed to include paying 3% of the cost of a single health care plan. Holidays were considered regular work days, so there was less holiday time, reduced minimum overtime guarantees for called back to work, the elimination of some OT work, suspended uniform maintenance allowance, suspended non-sworn law enforcement support penalty, no extra night shift extra pay. That was reduced. Employees taking home county cars have to pay $50 each pay period toward maintenance. Would you agree to any of those to continue come October 1st?
Well, let me tell you, for the last 3 years, my members have agreed to help out the community, and they have given up 25% of their salary with the agreement that he was going to have these snapbacks come back. This is part of an agreement that he made with us, part of a contract, no different than the contracts that he has with his lobbyist friends or with contractors that do construction work for the county. He honors those contracts, whether it be the Heat, the Miami Dolphin, or whatever. Why are we different? He needs to honor ours just as well as he does all of those other people I named.
John, John Rivera, do you support higher taxes in order to pay for those snapbacks?
Well, let me tell you something. I think that a community has to pay for the type of services that it wants. Miami touts itself as being, you know, one of the greatest metropolitan areas in the United States of America, and wants to pay for public safety on the cheap. So if that's an answer for you, that higher taxes, I mean, it's got to be commensurate with what you want to provide the community.
To pay for public safety on the cheap. John Quick with Friends of Miami-Dade Public Libraries, you got a slightly higher tax rate. It sounds like you'd support more because you wanted more dollars.
Well, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to come from a tax rate, because in terms of the countywide,
could it come from operational efficiencies and other places in the library budget?
Well, it could come from a number of places, but one of which, the library district is a separate district and does not actually encompass the entire county.
That's
so
right.
If there's a bump in the library district, it does not necessarily mean that people would see a bump in their property taxes, or that there would even be a countywide bump. So, turning to what John had said, you know, I always look at the two sides of the coin. You know, don't offer services you can't afford, but at a minimum, pay for the services you believe in. And our county says they believe in libraries, among others, as well as police.
John Quick is with the Friends of the Miami-Dade Public Libraries. John Rivera with the Miami-Dade County Police Benevolent Association. John Rivera with the police, if you come to October 1st with still no contract, your organization is barred from going on strike. But what happens October 1st with no contract, no agreement?
Well, we're going to have to see if the mayor's going to come through with his threats.
And what about from the union?
from the union, we're standing by. We're waiting to see. We want him to honor his contract just like he does everybody else. That's our bottom line.
John, of the 200-some-odd positions that could be on the chopping block in the police department if the mayor's worst-case budget goes through, how many of those are empty right now? In other words, how many of those are unfulfilled?
Well, if you ask the county mayor's office, he's going to tell you one. We have records that show anywhere between 110 to 175.
Are empty positions right now?
Yes, sir.
Are empty positions right now?
We're actually 328 short. We're going to lose 240 in the next 18 months because of mandatory retirement. And if he lays off another 400 or 200, whatever, because the numbers keep changing, he's going to wind up losing about 40% of his police force, which at one time was considered the premier police force in America.
Yeah. Finally, John Quick, how would you assess the support that you got from the administration, especially from the outgoing library administration, in regards to the dollars that you've been asking for?
You know, I'd say that it's a difficult position for a director of any county department to be out there advocating. But I will say that when the library was funded at the proper levels, it was a world-class library. Unfortunately, since fiscal year 2009-2010, we've seen a disproportionate decrease in the budget, almost a 26% decrease, whereas countywide it's only been about 3.5%. You know, in terms of the services that are offered with the funding that they have, I think they've done a wonderful job.
John Quick with the Friends of the Miami-Dade Public Libraries, John Rivera with the Miami-Dade Police Benevolent Association here on the Florida Roundup. Thank you both for your comments. The program is produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Wilson Sayre and Steph Farrow. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Technical supervisor today is Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening.